Morning, everyone. We have kind of a thin crowd today. There are some who are out due to illness. Others are traveling. But we're thankful for your presence this morning. I want to begin by, first of all, expressing my appreciation to Larry and to Steve for covering for me last week while Melissa and I were down in Texas. It was good to get away for a while and visit loved ones down there. We brought three of them back with us. It's good to have John and Joanna and Elsie here with us. As you know, John has accepted a job offer at NetApp here in Wichita. It starts tomorrow. And got them moved in this weekend. So we really look forward to having them there. Melissa and I are very excited about having at least one grandbaby close by, finally. And I'm confident that they will be a great asset to the work here, very active, as I'm sure we will be an encouragement to them. As you know, of course, we have now officially put 2012 behind us. Everybody that is, of course, except for Gene Turner, who still has the 2012 taxes to deal with, and we'll all get through that, but as far as the year itself is concerned, that's history. Now it's behind us. And we're all turning our attention now to the new year that is before us. And I'm confident that most of us have done what we do in January of every year, and that is we have made resolutions. New Year's resolutions, we call them. This year, I'm going to do X, Y, or Z. Things that I have always wanted to do, always needed to do, and I know I've got to do it, and this year it's going to get done. Well, now it's already, what, January 13th? How many of those resolutions have already crashed and burned? Now we know, speaking realistically here, we know that so many of the resolutions that we make at the beginning of the year probably have a very poor chance of ever being followed through to completion. We know that from experience, don't we? How many times have we made New Year's resolutions or otherwise in times past? We have made commitments to ourselves and to others that I'm going to make some changes in my life, things that I know that I've got to do or bad habits that I need to get rid of, whatever it is. We've resolved that we're going to do these things, and we'll give it a shot, we'll give it a go, we'll work hard at it for a period of time, and then we stumble and fall, and it becomes harder and harder, and we finally just throw up our hands and go back to the way things were. It's so much easier to maintain the status quo than it is to make the kind of changes that need to be made. You remember at Mount Sinai, when Israel had come up out of the land of Egypt, in Exodus chapter 19, God had told the Israelites, just prior to giving them the Ten Commandments in the following chapter, He said, if you will obey me and keep my commandments, then you will be a holy people to me. You will be a kingdom of priests. And in verse 8, the Israelites said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. Now, what is that? That's a resolution. That's a commitment. Whatever their life in the past may have been, they're making a determination now, a promise to God, we are going to do what you have told us to do. And how long did it take them then to lapse into a habit of complaining and murmuring and grumbling against God, and in some cases, outright rebellion against God? You see, here's a classic case of a resolution that was made at the beginning that a people, in this case, a whole nation of people, struggled to follow through on. They found it virtually impossible to do the thing that they had committed themselves to do. And that's why we read at the outset of our worship this morning from this passage in Romans chapter 7, a great description of the struggle that I'm sure every one of us can relate to. This is the classic description that Paul gives of the person who wants to do the right thing, finding it very difficult to follow through and make it happen. Look especially at what he says in verse 19, for the will to present, or for to will is present with me. That is, I have the desire to do it. If I were to look within my heart, if you could see within my heart, you would know, I want to do this. I want to make this change in my life. But how to perform what is good, I do not find. For the good that I will to do, I do not do, but the evil I will not to do, that I practice. There are some good things that I know I ought to be doing in my life. I acknowledge that they're good. There's no argument there. And I want these things to be present in my life. But I just struggle mightily to incorporate them in life and make them an habitual part of my character. On the other hand, there are some things that I know that are bad. They're not good for me or for those around me. I ought to eliminate these bad habits from my life. And yet I keep doing it. I hate it. I don't like it. It makes me miserable. But there it is. And what Paul is describing here in this passage is, again, I'm confident, something that every one of us can relate to one extent or another. And so here we are, beginning of a new year, and we have our own little stack of New Year's resolutions that in the back of our minds, we fear what's going to happen to those resolutions. They don't stand a chance. They're just realistically a very slim chance that any of those will ever be fully implemented in my life. And like Paul, we're miserable about it. Oh, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? Can't we relate to that? Don't we wish that it was as easy as just waving a magic wand and I'm a different person? All the good things that I want to implement in my life, voila, I'm that kind of person. All the bad habits I want to get rid of, poof, they're gone. Wouldn't it be great if that's the way this worked? Well, you know and I know that that's unfortunately not the way it works. Paul struggled back in the first century. The great Apostle Paul struggled then trying to be the kind of person he knew God wanted him to be. And we struggle today with the same failures. So what I'd like to do today is to present the first of a two-part series on how we can change our lives. Is it indeed possible for a person who recognizes I ought to change from what I am into something else that would be better than what I am currently? Is it possible to make that change? Yes. But as Paul himself testified, it's not as easy as just saying change and there it is. There's obviously something else that has to be at work here in order to make the kind of change in my life that I need to make. So this morning we're going to be looking at understanding why we have the struggle. Why are we like this? I call this understanding me. If I can just understand what are the factors that make it such a difficulty for me to make these changes in my life, that's at least a step toward being able to tackle and conquer these changes that I need to make. Next week then, Lord willing, we're going to build upon this study and actually look at how we can win the struggle against the bad habits and the changes and so forth that we need to make in our life. In Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 8, Solomon wrote, "The wisdom of the prudent is to understand his way." And that really is the first step to making the kind of improvements that we realize we need to make in our life. We need to understand who we are and the path that we are in, and whether it's right or wrong or what changes, adjustments need to be made along the way. And that is what Solomon calls wisdom. We are prudent people if we can at least understand the way that we are in and how we need to change from that. What I'd like to do this morning then is to look at six influences or factors that affect who we are, the kind of people that we are. These six factors mold us into the kind of people that we are and that in many cases we don't like. That's not to say that all these influences are bad. Some of them are bad or can be bad. Some of them can actually be quite positive if we recognize a strategy for using them in that respect. But they are present in the lives of every one of us. Whether or not we've ever paused to consider how we got to the point that we're at, I'm hoping that this study will help you appreciate, okay, I understand, this is why I struggle so much. This is why it is so difficult for me to make the kind of changes that I need to make in my life. So let's look at these. The first one we want to consider is the role of genetics. By that I mean things that we are born with. Call them genetic predispositions, if you will. Turn to Genesis chapter 25, and we have a classic story of twins. Two boys who were born to the same set of parents, come from the same womb at the same time, and you would think if ever there was a case of resolving this nature versus nurture issue, this would be it. But notice what happens. These two boys were born. Of course, you're familiar with the story. Jacob and Esau were their names. Look at verse 25. The first came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over, so they called his name Esau. Afterward, his brother came out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them, so the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a mild man dwelling in tents. Now, this is a simple description of what every parent of multiple kids, or especially parents of even twins, and I could even, I think, so far as to say identical twins, although much less so, but in this case, these were not identical twins, very clearly. Physically, they were not identical. Esau singled out as being red in complexion and hairy, apparently in contrast to his twin brother Jacob. Esau, as he grew up, was a skillful hunter, a man of the field. That was what his personality or his character traits, if you will, tended toward. He was an outdoorsman. He liked being out there in the wild. Jacob, on the other hand, his twin brother, was a mild man dwelling in tents. He wasn't all that interested in the outdoors. He much preferred the domestic life. Now, how do you explain these two boys coming from the same womb at the same time, having the same upbringing, how could they turn out so different? Because they are different. That there were certain genetic predispositions regarding these two young men. Just as they were physically different, their personalities were different. Now, the reason that we emphasize this is because you just look at yourself compared to other people around you. And I'm sure you see this in the vast swath of the population around you, is that people are different. They have different likes, different dislikes, different personality traits that tend in one direction or the other direction. And it's not because somebody forced them into those molds. In many cases, it's because that's just what they were born with. These are, as we say, genetic predispositions that they just grew up with. For example, some people tend to be just naturally ambitious. They are the gung-ho go-getters that just thrive on getting things done. That's what they are. And they just can't imagine living any other way. There are other people, on the other hand, who are lazy. They have to push and push and push themselves to get anything done. They're perfectly happy to just sit back, relax. They don't get the ambition thing. Now, does that mean one is good and the other is bad? Not necessarily. Both of those have some positive qualities about them. Both of them have some potentially negative qualities about them. There are some people who are naturally outgoing. They're the life of the party. They walk into a room, the place just lights up. Everybody gravitates to them, and they enjoy it. They thrive on that. And there are other people who are naturally very shy and reserved and introverted. They walk into a room, and nobody notices they're there, and they're perfectly happy with that. Now, what makes them that way? To a very large extent, that's a personality trait they were born with. Some people are very studious. They prefer curling up in an easy chair with a big, thick book, or better yet, a stack of books, and just reading and studying. And they're happy with that. They can just lose themselves in that kind of work, to the point, in some cases, that they neglect some other necessities of life that they ought to be spending more time on. Other people could care less about the books, and they're more the adventurous sort. We could compare that person to Esau. They love the outdoors, getting out and enjoying the world that God has put them in. And the study and the research and reading books, I mean, that's just not them. Now again, which of these is good and which is bad? You can't place that label on either one of these. Each of these are gifts or talents that can be used in some very productive ways, assuming the people understand the strengths and weaknesses that they have in these regards. There are some people who I'm convinced are born with a predisposition to hot-temperedness. They have a hair-trigger temper. It doesn't take very much to just set them off. You say something wrong or do something wrong, cut them off in traffic or whatever, and just boom, they explode. They really have a hard time controlling their temper. There are other people, on the other hand, that are patient. I would say almost patient to a fault. You can't make them angry. But you can walk on them, and they'll let you do it. Now, you see the point that I'm making here. And you can just add to this list, go on and on. In fact, in many of these cases that we're just looking at, what we're looking at is extremes on a spectrum, right? And so some people are on one extreme of the spectrum, other people are at another extreme on the spectrum in any one of these given character traits. And there's nothing necessarily good or bad about any of these. We call them strengths or weaknesses. And the idea is that they have to recognize what their strengths are and build on those strengths and then recognize what their weaknesses are and work to mitigate or overcome or minimize the effect of the weaknesses in their inborn personalities. Now, that's just part of what's there. Now then, you'll notice the statement that I have on the chart here is a lot of people recognize, if they can't articulate it very well, they recognize that there are certain personality traits about them that make them, they put them on one extreme or the other in a long list of categories of personality traits. And they look at that and they recognize it, and then they just stand back and say, well, that's just the way I am. As if to say, I can't change anything. I can't change that. I can't affect that. That's just the way I am. Let me suggest to you, I would even go so far as to say that I'm not going to argue with people that will hold forth that there is a genetic predisposition to homosexuality. Now, wow, that's pretty wild. But did you notice my wording there? A genetic predisposition. There are people who have a genetic predisposition to having a hot temper. Does that give them an excuse to just blow up any time? Well, you just have to live with it. That's the way I am. No, they have to work on controlling that. It's the same with homosexuality. I think the science is still out on this. It's not a settled matter. But if, in fact, it could be proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that there is a genetic predisposition to homosexuality, God's Word trumps the predisposition. People have to deal with that. They have to work on it. They have to manage it. All I'm trying to suggest here is that we can't just shrug our shoulders and just say, well, that's just the way I am. Everybody's just going to have to deal with that. No. It means that's what you were born with, yes, but you're going to have to work on dealing with it, on managing it, on controlling it, channeling whatever you were born with genetically into the proper path or channel that you need to go. In Matthew 26, in verse 41, you remember that Jesus said to the apostles who were sleeping while he was praying just before he was crucified, he told them the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. And that pretty well summarizes what we're dealing with here. The spirit is willing. As Paul said, there's a thing I know I ought to be doing. The good that I want to do, that's the spirit, I do not do. That's the flesh. We're always going to have these personality traits, genetic predispositions, whatever they are, good or bad, they're always going to be pulling on us, dragging us in a certain direction. It's up to us to manage those personality traits, whatever they might be. Let's look at the second factor that influences or molds or shapes who we are as individuals, and that is our upbringing. Usually, the vast majority of cases, of course, this is going to be our parents. What kind of role have our parents played in making us who we are? You're familiar with the proverb, Proverbs 22 and verse 6, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Now, the unspoken corollary to that proverb is, however you train up a child, when he is old, he will not depart from it. Now, obviously, the intent of the proverb is to encourage parents to train up their child in the way they should go. But the fact remains that many of us did not have perfect parents. Raise your hands if you did. I don't see any hands go up. No parent is going to be perfect. And if you want to point to mistakes that your parents made in raising you, there's no challenge. I think every one of us can recognize mistakes that our parents have made. And if those of us who are parents can probably, I think, if we're really honest with ourselves, recognize, I haven't done the best job as a parent myself. We're all imperfect human beings. And this great, noble task of raising children is something that every parent is going to struggle with to one extent or another. Do the best that they can, they're still going to make mistakes. And each one of us can probably look back on our upbringing and recognize that there were mistakes that were made by our parents. Now, whether those mistakes were deliberately inflicted upon us by conscious decisions that our parents made, or in some cases, they may have been unintended. Our parents were doing what they really thought was in our best interest, and it just didn't quite turn out the way they wanted. Maybe they weren't adapting their parenting style to our personalities. And we won't chase that rabbit trail, but there is a great case that can be made that parenting styles have to be adjusted to the character, the personality of the child. You can't raise 2, 3, 4, 5 kids in the same family exactly the same way, cookie-cutter fashion, because the kids are different. But again, I won't chase that. I'm only trying to emphasize the fact that our upbringing, the parenting that we were exposed to as children, is going to influence how we turn out as adults. Several months ago, I preached a lesson based on 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 18. If you would turn there, and we're just going to look at this very briefly. In verse 18, 1 Peter 1, the apostle writes, knowing that you are not redeemed with corruptible things like silver or gold from your aimless conduct received by tradition from your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. Notice carefully the statement in the latter part of verse 18, your aimless conduct received by tradition from your fathers. I think the New American Standard says that which was inherited from your forefathers. Now, what Peter's describing here is not the Calvinistic idea of inherited depravity, that we have somehow been tainted with Adam's original sin that's been passed down father to son all the way down through the ages. That's not what Peter is saying here. He is describing what I think could best be called behavioral inheritance. That is, we grow up in an environment that is created by our parents or our guardians, whoever they might be. And that environment is going to leave a very profound imprint on us as we grow out of childhood and enter into adulthood. Some would go so far as to say, and I think this is an accurate way of describing it, that we tend to carry baggage from our childhood. There are things that we were subjected to as children. Hopefully they were not too traumatic, but in some cases they are. But they are things that we carried with us from our childhood, and they still impact us as adults. And that is why earlier generations of psychologists made a big deal of laying you out on the couch, and let's review your relationship with your father or with your mother and all these childhood experiences. And if we can go in and unlock all these secrets from your childhood, then we can understand better who you were and why you are the way you are. Now, a lot of that went off into ridiculous extremes, but I think there was a kernel of truth there. Namely, that what we were exposed to as children does have some impact on how we turn out today. In Exodus chapter 20 and verse 5, there's a statement that is made, that God makes with regard to the giving of the Ten Commandments that has, I think, some implications here. Look in Exodus chapter 20 and in verse 5. This is part of the third commandment, you shall not make for yourself a carved image. And then he says in verse 5, you shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. God will visit the iniquities of the fathers to the third and fourth generations. Does that seem fair to you? That God is going to punish grandchildren and great-grandchildren for the sins or mistakes made by the first generation? If you're going to interpret it that way, it's just an arbitrary punishment. Yeah, that's not fair. In fact, God contradicts that elsewhere in Ezekiel 18 and other places. The father shall not bear the iniquity for the son, or the son bear iniquity for the father's sins. That's not what God is saying here. The bearing the iniquity, or visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations, is not some kind of arbitrary punishment on the later generations. He is describing that the character traits or the behavior patterns that were created in the first generation are going to carry on into later generations, and those generations are going to pay the price for the character, for the behavior patterns that were established in that first generation. Historical case in point, Abraham. What was his besetting sin? We have two accounts of Abraham committing the same sin. He was deceiving others on account of his wife, Sarah. Do you remember that? What did his son Isaac do? Exact same sin. What did Jacob do? His relationship with his father-in-law and with others. Deceived. And then the ultimate. We're now in the fourth generation. Jacob had 12 sons. What did most of those sons do when they got mad at their little brother Joseph? They sold him into slavery in Egypt, and what did they do to their father Isaac? They deceived him. You've got the same sin. The sin of the father, Abraham, being passed down from generation to generation. Were they born that way? Was it genetically part of their makeup? No. That was the environment that these boys were raised in. They just grew up with that. If you get in a bind, you kind of lie your way out of it. And so it's no wonder that we see deception playing such a big role. And you can see the same pattern unfold in families today. Mistakes that were made in one generation tend to perpetuate themselves generation after generation. And pity the poor grandkids and great-grandkids that end up with the mess totally dumped in their laps. They're just ruined. Child abuse, alcoholism, drug addiction, all of that tends to run through generations. Why? because of what we're talking about here. The way that people are raised up, the environment in which they are raised, is going to have a deep impact on how they turn out. And in fact, that's the way people tend to explain themselves and why they act the way they do. That's just the way I was raised. And that excuses it? Well, I don't know. It's just the way I was raised. You just have to understand that's the way I was raised, and there's not much we can do about that now. We can't go back and, you know, turn the clock back and undo all of that, and that's just the way I was raised, and that's the way I turned out. I'm sorry about that. Let's move on to the third one. Our peers have a tremendous impact on how we live our lives. In 1 Corinthians 15, in verse 33, Paul said, "Do not be deceived. Evil companionship corrupts good morals." That's become a proverb in our own culture today. Evil companionship corrupts good morals. A good person can, with sufficient exposure to the wrong influence, become corrupted, become something that he or she did not start out with. In Proverbs chapter 13 and verse 20, Solomon writes, "He who walks with wise men will be wise, but the companion of fools will be destroyed." Who you walk with, the friends that you choose to associate with, are going to have a tremendous influence on the kind of person that you turn out to be. We could look at Lot, who in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 8, we're told was a righteous man, but his soul was vexed by the immorality that he saw around him in the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. In 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 1 and 2, you remember the story of Solomon, wisest man who ever lived. Well, what happened to Solomon? He married so many of these foreign women who brought in their foreign gods with them that they turned his heart away from God. Here was a man who had every advantage to be the best, wisest, most good man that could ever be. And it was his association with all of these foreign women that eventually ruined him. And look at your own life. What impact do your coworkers have on you? The language that you speak, the way that you act, the way that you conduct yourself. Your friends, people, some of which you may have grown up with from high school, or other friends or neighbors that you run around with, and the one person that's going to have the single greatest influence in your life as far as somebody else influencing how you turn out is your spouse. That person is going to have a critical impact on the kind of person that you are going to be for the rest of your life. Young people, take note. Be very careful who you marry. In fact, I would even back it up before that. Be careful who you date. Because have you ever noticed people tend to marry people who they date? How does that work out? So, we need to be careful with who we run around with, the circle of friends that we surround ourselves with, because that's going to have a tremendous influence on the kind of people that we are. Whether we can or cannot change our lives is going to be influenced by the kind of people we surround ourselves with. And of course, people have a way of explaining this. Why am I the way I am? Why do I continually make the mistakes that I make? Well, it's their fault. Isn't that what Adam told God when God questioned him in the matter of the eating the forbidden fruit? Well, you see, the woman that you gave to me, she gave me of the fruit and I ate. It's somebody else's fault. Right? Do you see a pattern beginning to unfold here as we're looking at these factors that influence the kind of life that we choose to live? There is a tendency to try to shift responsibility. That you see, I'm just a victim here. It's not my fault. There are all these other things that are just stacked up against me that have forced me into this mold that I currently live in. But let's take it a step further. And you'll notice also there's a pattern here that we're looking at. We're starting with the items that we have the least control over. Genetic predispositions. I had nothing to do with that. How my parents raised me. There was very little that I had to do with that. But as we go down this list, you'll notice more and more there are things that I do have some measure of control over, how I interact with these things. And the fourth one now that we're going to look at is culture. Now, I'm using the word culture here, knowing full well that it's not a word that is found in the Bible, but I think there is a synonym that is used in the Bible that is appropriate for our purposes here. Look at 1 John chapter 2. We're going to read verses 15 through 17. John says, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away, and the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever." What John calls the world in his day is what today we call the culture. That's a very broad, generic term or label that we put on just the whole context of the society in which we live around us. And it encompasses all kinds of different specific influences. For example, entertainment. How do we choose to entertain ourselves? Now, some entertainment, we understand, can be perfectly innocent. Not a thing wrong with it. But there are other forms of entertainment that can be very damaging. How do we choose? What are other people around us choosing to entertain themselves with? What impact does the media have on us? If we sit in front of a television evening after evening after evening, or if we're home all day and we watch the soap operas day after day after day, what are we exposing our minds, our hearts, our wills to? What are we allowing ourselves to be influenced by as we listen to this day after day? Our government can have an influence in our lives, in the decrees and the decisions and the laws that it passes down that we have to live under. Our religion, or lack thereof, can likewise influence how we live our lives, or the religion that we are surrounded by, that other people are influenced by. Today, of course, we're increasingly heavily influenced by a new wave of people who are militantly opposed to the very idea of God, suggesting that religion itself, regardless of any good religion or bad religion, they say that all religion is evil, destructive, immoral, and ought to be eliminated. Now, when we find ourselves, and especially on college campuses, young people are exposed to this, find ourselves constantly exposed to this message that religion is bad. The idea of God is bad. And we need to ban all of this. When people are constantly exposed to that, do you think that's not going to have some impact on how they think? Our education. Who's teaching our children? What kind of moral, spiritual values do they have, if any? You know, we turn our kids over to an education system for 12 years or more if they go into college. Do we really know what our kids are being exposed to? Are we trying to offset or counter or bolster the kind of morality and teaching that we feel like they need to have? Do we even know what they're being exposed to? And all I'm saying is that there are just a lot of things that we're exposed to in the world out there. As we go about the day-to-day business of ordinary life, it's impossible not to be affected by these things. And they're going to have an impact on us. And that then is why some people will resort to the fallback position, well, everybody does it. What's the big deal? Have you ever heard people argue that? What's the big deal? Everybody does it. Oh, it may have been taboo 50 years ago, but society has changed. It's no big deal today. Everybody does it. So why get all bent out of shape over it? When deep inside we know, you know, this really isn't good. It really isn't best for me and my future and those who are close to me. but we'll try to defend it anyway. But let's move on. The fifth factor that has a profound influence on why we are the way we are is habit. Habit is simply the sum total of the first four things that we've been looking at here. You look at the influence that all these four factors up to this point have had on our lives, and we began to develop a certain pattern of behavior, a way of doing things that just becomes, what's the word? Habitual. We get to the point that we don't think about it anymore. And so in Proverbs chapter 5 and verse 22, Solomon again said, speaking of the evil man, his own iniquities entrap the wicked man, and he is caught in the cords of his sin. I love the metaphor there. The idea of a person getting himself in a position where his hands are tied. It's the cords of his own sins that have tied him up. And he has no more control over his future, over his life, or what he does or does not do. He's tied down. And what is it that tied him down? Solomon says, his own iniquities. He is caught in the cords of his sin. However we get to the point that we decide this is the kind of life that I'm going to live, and we usually establish that pretty early in adulthood. Coming out of childhood, in the early years of adulthood, we settle on a way of life that in some cases is detrimental to us and to others. And Solomon says, as that person's life goes on, those cords get wound tighter around him to the point that he can't break it. We have a word for that, don't we? What is it? Addiction. People become addicted to a certain kind of behavior. They cannot break the chain. They cry out for help. They know their lives are a mess. And they can't break it. They cannot get out of it. Look in Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 3. Beginning in verse 2, well, we'll start in verse 1. Paul said, "And you he made alive who were dead in trespasses and sins in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience, among whom also we all once conducted ourselves in the lust of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as the others." Conducted ourselves in the lust of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind. Now that is pretty much what Solomon was describing it, wasn't it? The person who's bound by his iniquities, by his own sins. And then he says, they were by nature children of wrath. Now some interpret that to mean that that's just the way we're born again, you know, that we inherited Adam's sin and we're totally corrupted from the day we're born. There's nothing we can do about it. I don't think that's what Paul is talking about here. Have you ever heard the expression, second nature? We do something by second nature. What we mean is we do it by habit. We don't even stop to think about it anymore. That's just second nature to us. That's just the way we live. That's just the way we act. That's the way we respond in any given situation. That's what he means when he says that we're by nature children of wrath. We become so set in this life of sin and iniquity and rebellion against God and just doing our own thing and not listening to anybody else, that we don't even think about it anymore. There's no decision process involved at this point. We're on autopilot. That's just the way we live. We're children of wrath by nature, by second nature. And these habits define who we are. Do you remember the story of the Israelites coming up out of the land of Egypt and they finally made it to the border of the Promised Land? sent the spies in. Spies came back and said, yeah, the land is everything God said it was. But they said, we are not able to take it. There are giants in the land, mighty fortified cities. We are not able. We can't do it. We were like grasshoppers in their sight. Some have called this the grasshopper complex. A feeling of self-rejection. I can't do it. I cannot conquer the challenge that is before me. We get ourselves in a position because of these bad behaviors that we've allowed ourselves to habitually get into, that we have just ceased any hope of ever improving, of ever becoming better than what we want to be. There's a statement that has been attributed to an ancient Chinese philosopher. Some have attributed it to Gandhi, the Indian reformer, and others. I don't know who originally came up with this, but it captures, I think, very succinctly the idea that we're talking about here. Thoughts become words. Words become deeds. Deeds become habits. Habits become character. And character becomes destiny. That's who you are. And it didn't just happen overnight. You see, we're creatures of habit. However we end up in this rut that we're stuck in, good or bad, we're now in a rut. We are creatures of habit that are stuck in doing the same thing over and over again. And if there are some inadequacies, if there are some bad things that are in that rut, in that habitual behavior, it's going to be a struggle to deal with that. And that's why you hear some people say, I'm too old to change. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. And there are people in their 20s saying that. That's throwing in the towel before you've even tried. That's a mistake that the Israelites made on the border of the land of Canaan. We're not able. We can't do it. I can't change. God begs to differ. You can change. We've talked about five of the six factors that influence who we are. I apologize, I'm running a little bit over. I'll make this fast. There's a sixth one here that I call the Joker in the deck. It's the one that trumps everything else. And you need to listen to this one carefully. And that is free will. The idea that I have as a creature of God, as a human being, I have the ability to choose to do something different. Yes, all of these other influences can be extremely powerful. They can have a great impact on the kind of life that I choose to live. But it is possible for me to exercise my free will to choose to live a different way. Notice what Moses told the Israelites. This is Deuteronomy chapter 30 and verse 19. He said, I call heaven and earth as witnesses today against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life, that both you and your descendants may live. Now, why would he tell these people to choose life if they had no ability to make that choice? They did have that ability. They did have that freedom of will to do that which was right. It is free will that enables a good boy from a good home to become a prodigal son. We've seen examples of that. It is free will that enables a boy who was raised in the ghetto with every strike against him. There's no possible way this kid could ever turn out good. But yet there are cases of boys growing up in an environment like that who have overcome all the adversaries against them to become medical doctors, engineers, businessmen. They made it. It didn't make any difference what the strikes were against them, all these bad influences that they grew up with. They knew, and that's how this person is going to look at his life, They knew, I am responsible for my life. What other people may have said or done, what I may have been exposed to in times past, all these other things, none of that really matters because I am ultimately responsible for the decisions that I make, for the path that I choose to walk in this life. We spoke a moment ago of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, how Adam was blaming God, blaming Eve. But you notice the last three words that he spoke as he was trying to defend himself against God? And I ate. Adam made a conscious decision to do something, and that's why he ended up where he was at. You see, all of these influences, yes, can have a profound impact on who we are and how we live our lives, but ultimately it falls on us to make a decision. Paul said, O wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? What can be done to help me overcome all these negative influences in my life, to exercise the free will, the will that I want to do what is right and get rid of the bad habits in my life? What can be done to help me do that? Come back next week and you'll find out. But you don't honestly have to wait till next week. If there's something that is a burden that's pressing on your heart right now, we will do anything that we can to help you and guide you and support you and pray for you in your efforts to get your life right with God. And if we can do that, we encourage you to come forward and express your need now as we stand and sing the invitation song.
There's a fountain free of tears for you and